thing, not only without prodding from above, but also without the government's advance permission or even knowledge. Initiative such as that was all too rare. Davis heard him out, and though he did not enjoy hearing his old friend and classmate Bishop Polk accused of bumbling and disloyalty, sustained him. Bragg was told to rejoin his army, which meanwhile was moving rapidly by rail via Stevenson, Alabama, from Knoxville to Tullahoma and Murfreesboro, where it would threaten Nashville and block a federal advance from that direction. Polk was summoned to the Capitol as soon as Bragg had left it. Invited to present his side of the controversy, the bishop came armed with documents, messages from Bragg to him, messages from him to Bragg, and affidavits provided by fellow subordinates, similarly disaffected, which he believed would protect his reputation and destroy his adversaries, or at any rate neutralize the poison lately poured into the presidential ear. "If you choose to rip up the Kentucky campaign, you can tear Bragg into tatters," Hardy told him. However, Davis urged him to put them away, appealing to his patriotism as well as his churchman's capacity for forgiveness, and the bishop agreed to go back and do his Christian best along those lines. By way of compensation, the president handed him his promotion to lieutenant general, a new rank lately authorized by Congress at the same time it legalized the previously informal division of the armies into wings and corps. That was gratifying. Equally so was the news that his friend Hardee's name appeared immediately below his own on the 7-man list of generals so honored. Above them both, next to the very top, in fact, was Kirby Smith, who thus was rewarded for his independent accomplishments in Kentucky, even though he had written to the War Department soon after his return, complaining acidly of Bragg's direction of the campaign during its later stages, and requesting transfer to Mobile or elsewhere, anywhere, if staying where he was would require further cooperation with that general. Davis himself replied to this on October 29th. He agreed that the campaign had been a bitter disappointment in some respects, but he also felt that events should not be judged by knowledge acquired after they transpired. Besides, having talked at length with Bragg that week, he could assure Smith that he spoke of you in the most complimentary terms, and does not seem to imagine your dissatisfaction. Davis admitted some other commanders might excite more enthusiasm than the dyspeptic North Carolinian, but he doubted that they would be equally useful to the country. In motion now for Middle Tennessee, Bragg would need reinforcements in order to parry the federal counterthrust from Nashville. Where were they to be procured, if not from Smith? He asked that, and then concluded, "When you wrote, your wounds were fresh, your lame and exhausted troops were before you. I hope time may have mollified your pain, and that future operations may restore the confidence essential to cheerfulness and security in campaign." That was enough for Smith, whose admiration for Davis was such that if the president requested it, he would not only cooperate with Bragg, he would even serve under him if it was absolutely necessary. Grateful, Davis sent for him to come to Richmond in early November. Smith went and, like Polk, gave the president his personal assurance that his rancor had been laid by, as indeed it had. A week later, he sent Bragg his strongest division, Stevenson's, and neither Smith nor any member of his staff permitted himself a public word of criticism of the leader of the Kentucky campaign for the balance of the war. Returning to Knoxville by way of Lynchburg, where he had convalesced from his Manassas wound and married the young lady who had nursed him, he had an unexpected encounter during a change of trains. "I saw General Bragg," he wrote his wife. "Everyone prognosticated a stormy meeting. I told him what I had written to Mr. Davis, but he spoke kindly to me, and in the highest terms of praise and admiration of my personal character and soldierly qualities. I was astonished, but believe he is honest and means well." Breckinridge was already with Bragg, in fact, had preceded the army to its present location. Following the repulse at Baton Rouge after wiring Hardee to reserve the division for me, he had reached Knoxville in early October with about 2,500 men. Reinforced by an equal number of exchanged prisoners, he had been about to start northward in order to share in the liberation of his native bluegrass, when he received word that Bragg was on the way back, and wanted him to proceed instead to Murfreesboro, where he was to dispose his troops for the defense of Middle Tennessee or an attack on Nashville. He got there October 28th, joining Forrest, who had been deviling the Federals by way of breaking in his newly recruited critter companies. Bragg's 30,000 veterans arrived under Polk and Hardee 10 days later, and when Stevenson's 9,000-man division marched in from Knoxville shortly afterward, the army totaled 44,000 infantry and artillery effectives, plus about 4,000 organic cavalry under Wheeler. This was by no means as large a force as Rosecrans was assembling within the Nashville entrenchments, but Bragg did not despair of whipping him when he emerged. Returning from Richmond with assurances of the president's confidence, he set about the familiar task of drilling his troops and stiffening the discipline which Buell had admired. Meanwhile, he turned Forrest and Morgan loose on Rosecrans front and rear. "Harass him in every conceivable way in your power," he told them. And they did, thus fulfilling the anticipation announced in general orders November 20th. Much is expected by the army and its commander from the operations of these active and ever-successful leaders. Nor were the infantry neglected in their commander's announcement of his hopes. Having posted Stevenson's division in front of Manchester, Hardee's corps at Shelbyville and Polk's at Murfreesboro, the latter now including Breckinridge, so that Polk had 3 and Hardee 2 divisions, Bragg announced in the same general order that the army had a new name. "The foregoing dispositions are in anticipation of the great struggle which must soon settle the question of supremacy in Middle Tennessee. The enemy in heavy force is before us with a determination, no doubt, to redeem the fruitful country we have wrested from him. With the remembrance of Richmond, Munfordville, and Perryville so fresh in our minds, let us make a name for the now Army of Tennessee as enviable as those enjoyed by the armies of Kentucky and the Mississippi." Presumably this was the best that could be done in that direction. Davis had sustained the army commander and persuaded his irate subordinates to lay aside their personal and official differences in order to concentrate on the defense of the vital center in Tennessee. South and west of there, however, the problem was not one of persuading delicate gears to mesh, but rather one of filling the near vacuum created by the bloody repulse Van Dorn and Price had suffered in front of Corinth. Vicksburg was obviously about to become the target for a renewed endeavor by federal combinations. What these would be, Davis did not know, but whatever they were, they posed a problem that would have to be met before they got there. He met it obliquely, so to speak, by turning initially to a second problem 700 miles away, whose solution automatically provided him with the solution to the first. This was the problem of Charleston, where the trouble was also an outgrowth of dissension. John Pemberton, in command there, had been a classmate of Bragg's and had several of that general's less fortunate characteristics, including an abruptness of manner which, taken in conjunction with his northern birth, had earned him a personal unpopularity rivaling the North Carolinians. Indeed, not being restricted to the army, it surpassed it. He was wanting in polish, according to one Confederate observer, and was too positive and domineering to suit the sensitive and polite people among whom he had been thrown. As a result, he had not been long in incurring the displeasure of Governor Pickens and the enmity of the Rhetts, along with that of other Charlestonians of influence, who by now were clamoring for his removal. They wanted their first hero back, meaning Beauregard. It was a more or less familiar cry to Davis, for others were also calling for the Creole, still restoring his shattered health at Bladen Springs. In mid-September, 2 Louisiana congressmen brought to the president's office a petition signed by themselves and 57 fellow members, requesting the general's return to command of the army that had been taken from him. Davis read the document aloud, including the signatures, then sent for the official correspondence relating to Beauregard's removal for being absent without leave. This, too, he read aloud as proof of justice in his action on the case, and closed the interview by saying, "If the whole world were to ask me to restore General Beauregard to the command which I have already given to General Bragg, I would refuse it." In any case, he had decided by then to use him in the opposite direction, meaning Charleston. Orders had been drawn up in late August, appointing Beauregard to command the Department of South Carolina and Georgia, with headquarters in Charleston. Whether he would accept the back-area appointment, which amounted in effect to a demotion, was not known, yet there should have been little doubt. For the choice, after all, lay between limited action and inaction. "Nil desperandum is my motto," he had declared, chafing in idleness earlier that month, "and I feel confident that ere long the glorious sun of Southern liberty will appear more radiant than ever from the clouds which obscure its brilliant disk." He wanted a share in scouring those clouds away. Receiving the orders in early September, he told a friend, "If the country is willing I should be put on the shelf through interested motives, I will submit until our future reverses will compel the government to put me on duty. I scorn its motives and present action." He wired acceptance, took the cars at Mobile on September 11th, and received a tumultuous welcome on the 15th when he returned to the city whose harbor had been the scene of his first glory. This not only freed the embittered Charlestonians of Pemberton, it also freed Pemberton for the larger duty Davis had in mind for him, along with a promotion as seventh man on the seven-man list of new lieutenant generals. Slender and sharp-faced, the 48-year-old Pennsylvanian had been pro-Southern all his adult life, choosing Southern cadets as his West Point friends and later marrying a girl from Old Point Comfort. He was indeed an out-and-out states writer, and it was generally known in Army circles that in making his choice of sides in the present conflict, despite the fact that two of his brothers had joined a Philadelphia cavalry troop, he had declined a federal colonelcy in order to accept a commission as a Confederate lieutenant colonel and assignment to Norfolk, where he had been charged with organizing Virginia's cavalry and artillery. Efficiency at that assignment had won him a brigadier's stars and transfer to Charleston, where his ability as an administrator, whatever his shortcomings when it came to social converse, had won him another promotion and eventually still another, along with another transfer in connection with the larger duty Davis had in mind. This was for Pemberton to take charge of a department created October 1st, consisting of the whole state of Mississippi and that part of Louisiana east of the Mississippi River, instructed to consider the successful defense of those states, one already invaded from the north, the other already invaded from the south, as the first and chief object of your command. He was told to proceed at once to his new post, which he did. Arriving October 14th, he established department headquarters at Jackson, Mississippi. There were, as usual, objections. Mainly, these came from men over whose heads he had been advanced in his rush up the ladder of rank, including Van Dorn and Lovell, here in his own department, as well as others back in the theater he had come from. Officers who, as one of them protested, had already distinguished themselves and given unquestioned evidence of capacity, efficiency, and other soldierly qualities. By this last, the disgruntled observer meant combat, for Pemberton had seen none since the Mexican War. Also, it was felt that he lacked the flexibility of mind necessary to independent command of a region under pressure from various directions. But the fact was, Davis had already taken this into consideration. Pemberton's main job would be to keep a bulldog grip on Vicksburg and Port Hudson, denying free use of the Mississippi to the Federals and keeping the stretch of river between those two bastions open as a Confederate supply line connecting its opposite banks. Inflexibility in the performance of such a job, even tactical and strategic nearsightedness of which the new commander was also accused by those who had known him in the East, might turn out to be a positive virtue when he was confronted, as surely he would be, by combinations which well might cause a more flexible man to fly to pieces. So Davis reasoned, at any rate, when he assigned the northerner to defend his home state. And at least one Vicksburg editor agreed, declaring that Pemberton's arrival at last demonstrated that the far-off Richmond government had not failed to appreciate the vast importance of preserving this important region, and that Mississippians were no longer to be put off and imposed upon with one-horse generals. Whatever their resentment of his rapid rise, his northern birth, his lack of exposure to gunfire, and his uncongenial manner, Pemberton's bypassed fellow officers, even Van Dorn, whose ruffled feathers Davis smoothed by explaining that the appointment had been made not to overslew him but to unburden him of paperwork and other back-area concerns in order to free him for the offensive action which he so much preferred, would doubtless have been less envious if they had been able to compare the magnitude of the new commander's first and chief object with the means which he had inherited for effecting it. He had fewer than 50,000 troops of all arms in his entire department, 24,000 under Van Dorn and Price, disaffected trans-Mississippians, for the most part, anxious to get back across the river for the close-up protection of their homes, and another 24,000 mainly comprising the permanent garrisons of Vicksburg and Port Hudson. Even without knowledge of the three-pronged federal buildup now in progress north and south of these two critical points, a combined force of more than 100,000 men supported by the guns of two fleets, it was obvious that the difficulties of the assignment would be exceeded only by the clamor which would follow if he failed, whatever the odds. Here, too, however, Davis had done what he could and as he thought best. Having sustained Bragg, installed Pemberton, and incidentally disposed of Beauregard, he found it in a way a relief to give his attention to the army closest to the capital, for its troubles, although manifold, were at least of a different nature. Though Lee's invasion had been less profitable than Bragg's, and his repulse far bloodier, no one could accuse him of unwillingness to exploit any opening the enemy afforded, regardless of the numerical odds or the tactical risks of annihilation. As a result, such disaffection as arose was not directed against him, either by his army or by the public it protected, but against Congress, which bridled at passing certain measures Lee suggested for the recruitment of new men, the establishment of proper supply facilities for the benefit of the men he had, including the more than 10,000 who now were marching barefoot in the snow, and the authority to tighten discipline. The president supported Lee in the controversy and wrote him of the scorn he felt for their opponents, who were reacting simultaneously to rumors that the enemy was about to advance on Richmond from Suffolk. The feverish anxiety to invade the North has been relieved by the counter-irritant of apprehension for the safety of the capital in the absence of the army, so long criticized for a want of dash, and the class who so vociferously urged a forward movement in which they were not personally involved would now be most pleased to welcome the return of that army. I hope their fears are as poor counselors as was their presumption. He assured the Virginian, "I am alike happy in the confidence felt in your ability and your superiority to outside clamor when the uninformed assumed to direct the movements of armies in the field." Lee replied characteristically, "I wish I felt that I deserved the confidence you express in me. I am only conscious of an earnest desire to advance the interests of the country and of my inability to accomplish my wishes." Davis left the field work to Lee while he himself took up the fight with Congress throughout its stormy second session, which extended from mid-August to mid-October. Two of the general's recommendations resulted in much violent debate. One, that a permanent court-martial be appointed with authority to inflict the death penalty in an attempt to reduce straggling and desertion. And two, that the Conscription Act be extended to include all able-bodied men between the ages of 18 and 45. The first of these suggestions was not only not acceptable to the lawmakers, it led to vigorous inquiries as to whether such powers had not been over-exercised already. But it was the second which provoked the greatest furor, especially after Davis gave it presidential support. Yancey was particularly vitriolic, shouting that if he had to have a dictator, he wanted it to be Lincoln, not a Confederate. Joe Brown of Georgia thought so too, declaring that the people had much more to apprehend from military despotism than from subjection by the enemy. A Texas senator added point to the assertion, as here applied, by recalling that it had been conscription which enabled Napoleon to put a diadem on his head. Davis met these charges with a bitterness matching that of the men who made them, and in the end he won the fight. Conscription was extended, but not without the estrangement of former loyal friends whose loss he could ill afford. As always, he was willing to pay the price, though it was becoming increasingly steep in obedience to the law of diminishing utility. At any rate, the measure helped secure for Lee the men he badly needed. And while Davis engaged these wranglers in the army's rear, the bluecoats to its front were obligingly idle, affording time for rest, recruitment, and reorganization of its shattered ranks. The need for these was obvious at a glance. Recrossing the Potomac, only 14 of the 40 brigades had been led by brigadiers, and many of them had dwindled until they were smaller than a standard regiment. Yet the return of stragglers and convalescents, along with the influx of conscripts, more than repaired the shortage in the course of the 5-week respite the Federals allowed. By October 10th, Lee's strength had risen to 64,273 of all arms, and within another 10 days, on which date McClellan reported 133,433 present for duty in the Army of the Potomac, he had 68,033, or better than half as many as his opponent. High spirits, too, were restored. Pride in their great defensive fight at Sharpsburg, when the odds had been even longer, and presently their jubilation over Stuart's second ride around McClellan, solidified into a conviction that the Army of Northern Virginia was more than a match for whatever came against it, even if the Yankees continued to fight as well as they had fought in Maryland. Shortages of equipment there still were, especially of shoes and clothes, but these were accepted as rather the norm and relatively unimportant. A British Army observer, visiting Lee at the time, expressed surprise at the condition of the trousers of the men in Hood's division, the rents and tatters being especially apparent after the first files had passed in review. "Never mind the raggedness, Colonel," Lee said quietly. "The enemy never sees the backs of my Texans." He spoke, the colonel observed, as a man proud of his country and confident of ultimate success. However, this was for the Southern commander a time of personal sorrow. Soon after October 20th, he heard from his wife of the death on that date of the second of his 3 daughters. She was 23 years old and had been named for his mother, born Anne Carter. He turned to some official correspondence, seeking thus to hide his grief, but presently an aide came into the tent and found him weeping. "I cannot express the anguish I feel at the death of my sweet Annie," he wrote home. Work was still the best remedy, he believed, and fortunately there was plenty to occupy him. The previously informal corps arrangement was made official in early November with the promotion of Longstreet and Jackson, respectively 1st and 5th on the list of lieutenant generals. By that time, moreover, the Federals had crossed the river which gave their army its name, and Lee had divided his own in order to cover their alternate routes of approach, shifting Old Pete down to Culpeper while Stonewall remained in the lower valley, eager to pounce through one of the Blue Ridge gaps and onto the enemy flank. But this was not Pope, this was McClellan. He maneuvered skillfully, keeping the gaps well plugged as he advanced against the divided Confederates. Then, suddenly, inexplicably, he stopped. For 2 days Lee was left wondering, until November 10th, that is, when he learned that Little Mac had been relieved. The Southern reaction was not unmixed. Some believed that the Federals would be demoralized by McClellan's removal, while others found assurance in the conviction that his successor would be more likely to commit some blunder which would expose the Blue Host to destruction. Lee, however, expressed regret at the departure of a familiar and respected adversary. "We always understood each other so well," he said wryly. "I fear they may continue to make these changes till they find someone whom I don't understand." When Burnside shifted east in mid-November, Lee's first plan was to occupy the line of the North Anna, 25 miles south of the Rappahannock. From there, he would draw the Bluecoats into the intervening wintry swamps and woodlands, then move forward and outflank them in order to slash at them from astride their line of retreat. If successful, this would have been to stage a sedan 8 years ahead of the historical schedule. Jackson, for one, was very much in favor of it. If, on the other hand, the Confederates contested the Rappahannock crossing, where the position afforded little depth for maneuver and was dominated by the North Bank Heights, it was Stonewall's opinion that they would whip the enemy but gain no fruits of victory. However, Lee did not want to give up the previously unmolested territory and expose the vital railroad to destruction. So, while Burnside balked at Falmouth, awaiting the delayed pontoons, the Southern commander moved Longstreet onto the heights in rear of Fredericksburg. This suited old Pete fine, for the position offered all the defensive advantages he most admired, if only the damned Yankees could be persuaded to come to us. Apparently they were coming, here or somewhere near here, but they were taking their time about it. "When are you coming over, Bluecoat?" "When we get ready, Butternut." For 10 days, Lee left the vigil to Longstreet, withholding Jackson for a flank attack if Burnside crossed upstream. Then, as the indications grew that a crossing would be attempted here, he sent for Stonewall, whose troops began to file into position alongside Longstreet's on the first day of December. By that time, the army had grown to 70,000 infantry and artillery, plus 7,000 cavalry, and its spirit was higher than ever, despite the fact that one man in every six was barefoot. They now bore with patience, one officer remarked, what they once would have regarded as beyond human endurance. Even a 4-inch snowfall on the night of December 5th, followed by bitter cold weather, failed to lower their morale. Rather, they organized brigade-sized snowball battles, during which their colonels put them through the evolutions of the line, and thus kept in practice while waiting for the Yankees to cross the river flowing slate gray between its cake-icing banks. Lee shared their hardships and their confidence. Sometimes, though, alone in his tent, he was oppressed by sorrow for the daughter who had died 6 weeks ago. "In the quiet hours of the night, when there is nothing to lighten the full weight of my grief," he wrote home, "I feel as if I should be overwhelmed. I have always counted, if God should spare me a few days after this civil war has ended, that I should have her with me, but year after year my hopes go out and I must be resigned." Mainly his consolation was his army, though he told his wife, "I tremble for my country when I hear of confidence expressed in me. I know too well my weakness and that our only hope is in God." His admiration for the men he led was almost without bounds. "I am glad you derive satisfaction from the operations of the army," he replied to a congratulatory letter from his brother. "I acknowledge nothing can surpass the valor and endurance of our troops. Yet while so much remains to be done, I feel as if nothing had been accomplished. But we must endure to the end, and if our people are true to themselves and our soldiers continue to discard all thoughts of self and to press nobly forward in defense alone of their country and their rights, I have no fear of the result. We may be annihilated, but we cannot be conquered. No sooner is one federal army scattered than another rises up. This snatches from us the fruits of victory and covers the battlefield with our dead. Yet what have we to live for if not victorious?" It was this spirit which made Lee's army terrible in battle, and it was in this spirit that he and his men awaited Burnside's crossing of the Rappahannock. Off in the Trans-Mississippi, the 6th of the new lieutenant generals, Theophilus Holmes, had established headquarters at Little Rock, and from there was surveying a situation which was perhaps as confusing for him as the one near Malvern Hill, where he had cupped a deaf ear in the midst of a heavy bombardment and declared that he thought he heard firing. If he was similarly bewildered, it was no wonder, considering the contrast between the geographical vastness of his command and the slimness of his resources. In addition to Texas and Missouri, the two largest states of the old Union, he was theoretically responsible for holding or reclaiming Arkansas, Indian Territory, West Louisiana, and New Mexico, in all of which combined he had fewer than 50,000 men, including guerrillas. These last were sometimes as much trouble to him as they were to the enemy, especially as an administrative concern, and even the so-called regulars were generally well beyond his reach, being loosely connected with headquarters, if at all, by lines of supply and communication which could only be characterized as primitive, telegraph wire being quite as rare as railroad iron. By late October, after 3 months of pondering the odds, he had begun to consider not only the probability of total defeat, but also the line of conduct he and his men would follow in the wake of that disaster. In this he showed that whatever his physical shortcomings and infirmities, his spirit was undamaged. "We hate you with a cordial hatred," he told an Indiana colonel who came to Little Rock bearing messages under a flag of truce. "You may conquer us and parcel out our lands among your soldiers, but you must remember that one incident of history, to wit, that of all the Russians who settled in Poland, not one died a natural death." Moreover, his three department commanders, John Magruder, Richard Taylor, and Thomas Hindman, respectively in charge of Texas, West Louisiana, and Arkansas, shared his resolution but not his gloom. All three were working even now on plans for the recovery of all that had been lost. Prince John, for example, as flamboyant in the Lone Star State as ever he had been in the Old Dominion, was improvising behind the scenes a two-boat cotton-clad navy with which he intended to steam down Buffalo Bayou and retake Galveston, the only federal-held point in his department. Taylor's ambition was longer-ranged, as well it had to be. New Orleans was occupied by something more than 10 times as many soldiers and sailors as he had in his whole command, but he had hopes for the eventual recapture of the South's first city, along with the lower reaches of the Father of Waters itself. Meanwhile, having recovered from the mysterious paralysis which had gripped his legs on the eve of the 7 days, thus preventing any addition to the reputation he had won under Jackson in the valley, he was working hard with what little he had in the way of men and guns, seeking first to establish dispersed strong points with which to forestall a further penetration by the gunboats and the probing Union columns, after which he intended to swing over to the offensive and reclaim what had been lost to amphibious combinations heretofore considered too powerful to resist with any substantial hope of success. Of the three, so far, it was Hindman who had accomplished most, however, and against the longest odds. Operating in a region which had been stripped of troops when Van Dorn crossed the Mississippi back in April, he yet had managed to raise and equip an army of 16,000 men, and with them he had already begun to launch an offensive against Schofield, who had about the same number for the protection of the Missouri border. By late August, Hindman was across it, or anyhow a third of his soldiers were, and he was preparing to join them with the rest. Skirting Helena, where 15,000 Federals were entrenched, they now were under Brigadier General Frederick Steele, Curtis having moved on to St. Louis and command of the department, belatedly rewarded for his Pea Ridge victory. The Confederate advance occupied Newtonia, beyond Neosho and southwest of Springfield. All through September they stayed there, 2,500 Missouri cavalry under Colonel J.O. Shelby, and about 3,000 Indians and guerrillas called in to assist in holding the place until Hindman arrived with the other 2/3 of his hastily improvised army. Shelby was a graduate of the pre-war Kansas border conflict, a stocky, heavily bearded man approaching his 32nd birthday. Called Joe for his initials, just as Stuart was called Jeb, and wearing like him an ostrich plume attached to the upturned brim of a soft felt hat. He was a veteran of nearby Wilson's Creek and of Elkhorn Tavern, 40 miles to the south. With him out front and the stone walls of the town to fight behind, the garrison was more than a match for a 4,000-man column Schofield sent to retake Newtonia on the last day of September. The Confederates broke the point of the counter-thrust and drove the Bluecoats north. However, learning 3 days later, October 3rd, Van Dorn and Price were moving against Corinth, that the Federals had been reinforced to thrice their former strength, they fell back next day in the direction of the Boston Mountains, Shelby skillfully covering the retreat with a succession of slashing attacks and quick withdrawals. Hindman was not discouraged by this turn of events. In fact, he saw in it certain advantages. Schofield should be easier to whip if he advanced into Arkansas, lengthening his lines of supply, and lengthening, too, the distance he would have to backtrack through the wintry woods in order to regain the comparative security of Missouri. Under such disadvantages, a simple repulse might be transformed into a disaster. At any rate, Hindman intended to do all he could to bring about that result. But as he prepared to move forward in early November, consolidating the segments of his army, he received news that was discouraging indeed. It came from Holmes, who had just received in Little Rock a dispatch from Richmond, dated October 27th and signed by the Secretary of War. "Cooperation between General Pemberton and yourself is indispensable to the preservation of our connection with your department. We regard this as an object of first importance, and when necessary you can cross the Mississippi with such part of your forces as you may select, and by virtue of your rank, direct the combined operations on the eastern bank." This meant, in effect, that Hindman's offensive would have to be abandoned, and when it was followed in mid-November by a specific request from the adjutant general, "Vicksburg is threatened and requires to be reinforced. Can you send troops from your command, say 10,000, to operate either opposite to Vicksburg or to cross the river?" Holmes perceived that it meant the abandonment not only of his hopes for regaining Missouri, but also of his hopes for hanging on to Arkansas. "I could not get to Vicksburg in less than 2 weeks," he protested. "There is nothing to subsist on between here and there, and Steele's army at Helena would come to Little Rock before I reached Vicksburg." However, he need not have worried. He was not going anywhere, nor was Hindman's offensive to be interrupted. At any rate, not by anyone in Richmond, and least of all by Thomas Jefferson's grandson, George Randolph. Presently it became fairly clear that the original dispatch sent by that official, though couched in the form of a military directive, was in effect an act of political suicide, whereby the Confederacy lost the third of its several secretaries of war. Joe Johnston was one of the first to get inside news of the impending disruption in the president's official family, and what was more, he got it at first hand. His Seven Pines wound had proved troublous, resulting in what the doctors called an obstinate adhesion of the lungs to the side and a constant tendency to pleurisy, for which the prescribed treatments were bleedings, blisterings, and depletions of the system. All three were stringently applied, in spite of which, having sufficiently recovered by early November to begin taking horseback exercise, "My other occupation," he told a friend, "is blistering myself, to which habit hasn't yet reconciled me." The general called at the War Department on the 12th of that month to report himself fit for duty. Closeted with the secretary, he learned that the government intended to send him west, where his assignment would be to coordinate the efforts of Bragg and Pemberton for the defense of Tennessee and Mississippi. Perceiving that each was not only too weak to reinforce the other, but also most likely too weak to handle what was coming at him, particularly the latter, since the Federals were certain to make Vicksburg their prime objective in the offensive they were clearly about to launch, Johnston at once suggested that the best solution would be to bring additional troops from the Trans-Mississippi to assist in the East Bank defense of the Big River. Randolph replied that he had reached the same decision more than 2 weeks ago and read to his fellow Virginian the dispatch he had sent Holmes. When he had finished, he smiled rather strangely and took up another document, which he also read aloud. It was dated today and signed by Jefferson Davis. "I regret to notice that in your letter to General Holmes of October 27th, a copy of which is before me, you suggest the propriety of his crossing the Mississippi and assuming command on the east side of the river. His presence on the west side is not less necessary now than heretofore, and will probably soon be more so. The cooperation designed by me was in co-intelligent action on both sides of the river of such detachment of troops as circumstances might require and warrant. The withdrawal of the commander from the Trans-Mississippi Department for temporary duty elsewhere would have a disastrous effect, and was not contemplated by me." Johnston recognized the tone, having received such directives himself. He knew, too, what response this son of Thomas Jefferson's oldest daughter was likely to make to such a letter. The question was, what had made him so deliberately provoke it? Yet Johnston knew the answer here as well. 8 months of service as the clerk of Mr. Davis, sometimes learning of vital military decisions only after they had been made and acted on, had brought home to Randolph the truth of one observer's remark, that the real warlord of the South resided in the executive mansion. The message to Holmes, sent without previous consultation with the commander-in-chief, was in the nature of a gesture of self-assertion, desperate but necessary to the preservation of his self-respect. And now he accepted the consequences. 2 days later, having added an endorsement to the offending document sent by Davis, "Enclose a copy of this letter to General Holmes and inform the President that it has been done, and that Holmes has been directed to consider it as part of his instructions," he submitted his formal resignation. This had been neither intended nor expected by Davis, who up to now had been highly pleased with Randolph as a member of his cabinet. Except for two particulars, he had not even disapproved of the Secretary's decision to bring troops across the river to assist in the defense of Vicksburg. In fact, he himself ordered this done that same week when he had the Adjutant General send Holmes the request for 10,000 men to be used for this very purpose. What he objected to most strenuously were the two particulars. One, that Holmes himself was advised to cross, which would leave his department headless, and two, that the thing had been done behind his back without his knowledge. It was this last which disturbed him most. As commander-in-chief, he saw himself as chief engineer of the whole vast machine. If adjustments were made without his knowledge, a wreck was almost certain. In this case, however, receiving the tart letter of resignation, he sought to prevent a break by suggesting a personal interview at which he and the Virginian could discuss their differences. Randolph declined, and Davis would bend no further. "As you thus, without notice and in terms excluding inquiry, retired," he replied, "nothing remains but to give you this formal notice of the acceptance of your resignation." G.W. Smith, recovered from the collapse he had suffered when Johnston's fall left him in charge of the confused and confusing field of Seven Pines, had been serving as commander of the Richmond defenses ever since Lee and his army departed to deal with Pope back in August. Now, Davis found a further use for the former New York Street Commissioner by assigning him to serve as head of the War Department during the 3-day interim, which he himself spent in search of a permanent, if the word could be used properly in reference to a position which so far had been so impermanent, replacement for Randolph, who retired at once to private life and subsequently refugeed in Europe with his family. Once more, the Old Dominion had been left without a representative among the President's chief advisers, and once more Davis solved the problem, this time by appointing James A. Seddon to be Secretary of War. A Richmond lawyer who had served 2 terms as U.S. Congressman from the district, a former occupant of the present Confederate White House and a descendant of James River grandees, Seddon ranked about as high in the complicated Virginia caste system as even Randolph did, with the result that his selection was a source of considerable satisfaction to those who had become accustomed to looking down their noses at what they called the middle-class atmosphere of official Richmond. Moreover, he had a reputation as a scholar and a philosopher, though what service this would be to him in his new position was unknown. He had had no previous military experience whatever. Nor was his appearance reassuring. Gaunt and emaciated, one observer called him, with long, straggling hair, mingled gray and black. He was 47, but looked much older, perhaps because of chronic neuralgia, which racked him nearly as badly as it racked Davis. He looked, in fact, according to the same diarist, like a dead man galvanized into muscular animation. His eyes are sunken, and his features have the hue of a man who has been in his grave a full month. At any rate, whatever his lack of the kind of training which would have cautioned him to guard his flanks and rear, it soon became apparent that he did not intend to expose himself to attack from above as his predecessor had done. Johnston went to him on November 22nd, the new secretary's first full day in office, and renewed his suggestion that troops be ordered east from the Trans-Mississippi. Seddon listened sympathetically. But when Johnston received his orders 2 days later, assigning him to the region lying between the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Mississippi River, he was surprised to find that they contained no reference to troops not already within those limits. The suggestion was not adopted or noticed, he afterwards recorded dryly. Davis had a higher opinion of Johnston's abilities at this stage than the Virginian probably suspected. "I wish he were able to take the field," the president had told Mrs. Davis during the general's convalescence. "Despite the critics who know military affairs by instinct, he is a good soldier, never brags of what he did do, and could at this time render most valuable service." In no way, indeed, could the commander-in-chief have demonstrated this confidence more fully than by assigning him, as soon as he was fairly up and about, to what was called plenary command of the heartland of the Confederacy. An area embracing all of Tennessee, Mississippi, and Alabama, together with parts of North Carolina, Florida, and Georgia, including the main regional supply base at Atlanta. Moreover, he placed on him no restrictions within that geographical expanse, either as to his movements or the location of his headquarters, which he was instructed to establish at Chattanooga or such other place as in his judgment will best secure facilities for ready communication with the troops within the limits of his command, and will repair in person to any part of said command wherever his presence may for the time be necessary or desirable. These instructions embodied a new concept of the function of departmental command, which in turn had been prompted by the example of R. E. Lee in his conduct of the defense of his native state. Lee's achievements here in Virginia, before as well as after he had been given field command, were in a large part the result of a successful coordination of the efforts of separate forces, either through simultaneous actions at divergent points, as when Jackson took the offensive in the valley, threatening Washington to play on Lincoln's fears while Johnston delayed McClellan's advance up the peninsula, or through rapid concentration against a common point, as when all available forces were brought together for the attack which opened the 7 days and accomplished the deliverance of Richmond. Subsequent repetition of this strategy, with a similar coordination of effort, had brought about the suppression of Pope and opened the way for invasion of the North, removing the war to that extent beyond the Confederate border. Now it was Davis's hope that such methods, which had won for Southern arms the admiration of the world, and for Lee a place among history's great captains, would result in similar achievements in the West, and give to the commander there a seat alongside Lee in Valhalla. Choice of Johnston for the post was prompted by more than the fact that he was entitled to it by rank. Not only did Davis consider him a good soldier who could render most valuable service, but the Virginian had also been asked for already by two of the three generals who would be his chief subordinates. During their recent visits to the Capitol, Bragg and Kirby Smith had both expressed an eagerness to have him over them, and doubtless Pemberton would be equally delighted to have the benefit of his advice, along with whatever reinforcements would become available in times of crisis as a result of the shuttle service the new theater commander was expected to establish between his several departments. How well he would do, whether he was potentially another Lee, and whether Bragg and Pemberton would serve him as well as Longstreet and Jackson had served the Eastern Commander, remained to be seen. So far, however, the resemblance had been anything but striking. His first reaction, expressed in a letter sent to the Adjutant General on the day he received the appointment, was a protest that his forces were greatly inferior in number to those of the enemy opposed to them. While in the Trans-Mississippi Department, our army is very much larger than that of the United States. He also complained of the presence of the Tennessee River, a formidable obstacle which divided his two main armies, and found it highly irregular that his department commanders, by an arrangement which Davis had designed to avoid delay, would be in direct correspondence with the War Department. This combination of drawbacks and irregularities, discerned by him before he even left Richmond, had already led him to suspect what he later stated flatly, that my command was a nominal one merely and useless. Depressed by these several misgivings, he began at once to make arrangements for his journey west, and 5 days later he was off, accompanied by his wife and a new staff. In the interim, however, he found time to attend a farewell breakfast given in his honor and also in the hope that it would effect a reconciliation between two of his political friends, Senators Foote and Yancey, who had quarreled despite the common bond of their detestation of Davis. Under the healing influence of their admiration for Johnston, along with that of a bountiful meal accompanied by champagne, the two statesmen forgot their differences. Presently, Yancey called for fresh glasses and proposed a toast. "Gentlemen, let us drink to the only man who can save the Confederacy, General Joseph E. Johnston." All applauded, drank their wine, and took their seats, whereupon the guest of honor rose, glass in hand, and responded. "Mr. Yancey," he said firmly, "the man you describe is now in the field, in the person of General Robert E. Lee. I will drink to his health." Not to be outdone, the silver-tongued Yancey rose and countered, "I can only reply to you, sir, as the Speaker of the House of Burgesses did to General Washington. Your modesty is only equaled by your valor." Again the celebrants applauded and drank the balding general's health, but he remained taciturn and preoccupied, as if his mind was already engaged by the frets he knew awaited him in the West. In the course of the 5-day trip to Chattanooga, delayed by no less than 3 railroad accidents, Johnston was much wearied despite the ministrations of his wife and the cheers from the station platforms along the way. Early on the morning of December 4th, he got there. After resting briefly, he issued an order formally accepting his new responsibilities, although his gloom was unrelieved. "Nobody ever assumed a command under more unfavorable circumstances," he wrote to a friend in Richmond that same day. Johnston's gloom, though it was not shared by the people in general, East or West, nor for that matter by those who cheered him from station platforms as he traveled from one to the other, was nonetheless reflected in the value of their dollar. After holding at 1.5 through August, it fell in October to 2, in November to 2.9, and by December it had dropped to 3. Statistics were dreary at best, however, except perhaps for those who dealt in money as a commodity. It was in terms of what the stuff would buy, shoved coin by coin across a counter or laid down bill by badly printed bill, that the meaning of such quotations really struck home. Now, with winter hard upon the Upper South, coal was $9 a hand cart load and wood $16 a cord. Bacon was 75 cents a pound, sugar 5 cents higher. Butter was $1.25 and coffee twice that. To the despair of Richmond housewives, laundry soap was 75 cents a cake, flour $16 a barrel, and potatoes $6 a bushel. For those of an analytical turn of mind, accustomed to looking behind effects for causes, it was more or less clear that the cause behind this particular close-to-home effect was the failure of the Confederacy's one concerted effort at invasion, east and west. Yet even here their reaction contained a good deal more of pride than of regret. It was to be expected, Davis had told them back at the outset, that this war would expose our people to sacrifices and cost them much, both of money and blood. It was, perhaps, in the ordination of Providence that we were to be taught the value of our liberties by the price we pay for them. In the light of this, Bragg's thousand-mile hegira through Kentucky and Lee's bloody defense of the Sharpsburg Ridge became for their countrymen not occasions for despair, but instances for the promotion of the growth of national pride and the evocation of applause from those who watched from afar. Whatever may be the fate of the new nationality, the London Times was saying, in its subsequent claims to the respect of mankind, it will assuredly begin its career with a reputation for genius and valor which the most famous nations might envy. Such public praise was welcome, as were certain private remarks from that same quarter. Thomas Carlyle, for example, though he pleased neither side with a reference to the American War as the burning out of a dirty chimney, a conflagration which could be regarded only with satisfaction by neighbors too long plagued by soot, amused and gladdened Southerners by subsequently professing his impatience with people who were cutting each other's throats because one half of them prefer hiring their servants for life and the other by the hour. Most gratifying of all, however, were the observations colorfully expressed in the course of a banquet speech made at Newcastle, October 7th, by Chancellor of the Exchequer William E. Gladstone. Professing the kindliest feeling toward the people of the North, "They are our kin, they were our customers, and we hope they will be our customers again," he denied that the British government had any interest in the disruption of the Union. But he also declared, with particular emphasis, "There is no doubt that Jefferson Davis and other leaders of the South have made an army. They are making, it appears, a navy. And they have made what is more than either. They have made a nation." This was greeted with applause and cheers. "Hear, hear," the diners cried. When they subsided, Gladstone added, "We may anticipate with certainty the success of the Southern states so far as regards their separation from the North." Coming as it did from the third-ranking member of the cabinet, the statement was assumed to reflect the views of the government, which it did, except that Palmerston and Russell considered it precipitate and unpropitious, which it was, the Prime Minister having recently advised the Foreign Secretary that he thought it best to wait a while and see what may follow Lee's retreat from Maryland. What had followed was the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, and though this document was greeted with sneers on the one hand and confusion on the other, it too provided an occasion for more waiting. Gladstone's outburst caused an immediate drop in the price of cotton, which apparently would soon be plentiful as a result of the lifting of the blockade, as well as an increase of activity by members of Parliament sympathetic to the North. On October 22nd, 2 weeks after the Newcastle speech, Palmerston wrote Russell, "We must continue to be mere lookers-on till the war shall have taken a more decided turn." On that same day, the French Emperor granted Slidell an audience at Saint-Cloud, during which he let the Confederate minister understand that he considered the time ripe for joint mediation by France, England, and Russia. "My own preference is for a proposition of an armistice of 6 months," he said. "This would put a stop to the effusion of blood, and hostilities would probably never be resumed. We can urge it on the high grounds of humanity and the interest of the whole civilized world. If it be refused by the North, it will afford good reason for recognition, and perhaps for more active intervention." 8 days later, as good as his word, and with his eye still fixed on the promised 100,000 bales of cotton, he addressed, through his Minister of Foreign Affairs, a dispatch to his ambassadors at St. Petersburg and London, proposing that the three governments exert their influence at Washington, as well as with the Confederates, to obtain an armistice. Russia's answer was emphatic. In our opinion, what ought specially to be avoided is the appearance of any pressure whatsoever of a nature to wound public opinion in the United States and to excite susceptibilities very easily aroused at the bare idea of foreign intervention. England's was scarcely less so, Russell declining for the reason that there is no ground at the present moment to hope that the federal government would accept the proposal suggested, and a refusal from Washington at the present time would prevent any speedy renewal of the offer. Napoleon, then, was as far as ever from those 100,000 bales, and so was the Confederacy from recognition by the powers of Europe. England was to blame, for France could act without Russia, but not without England. England swung the balance. And yet, admittedly, Southerners already had much to be thankful for, if not from the British government, then at least from British individuals, particularly the owners of and workers in shipyards up the Mersey. Gladstone's remark that the Confederates are making, it appears, a navy, was based on solid ground, ground which, indeed, was of his own countrymen's making. In late July, a powerful new screw steamer, known mysteriously as the 290, had steamed down from Liverpool, supposedly on a trial run, but headed instead for the open sea and a rendezvous off the Azores, where she took on provisions, coal, and guns, struck her English colors in favor of the Stars and Bars, swore in a crew, and exchanged her numerical designation for a name, the Alabama.